From the Paradise Hotel in East Peoria, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 18th day of December. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason in Chicago. Over the noon hour, futures were a bit lower with wheat leading the market down, off about 9 cents for the day. Corn futures at that hour down around 3, so were soybeans. Jackie Vakes is now with us to take a look at some of these numbers and what's been happening in the marketplace. Hey, thanks so much for joining us early today. I sure do appreciate that, Jackie. I kind of want to start where we always do while we're in the middle of the trading day while you and I are talking. But with those support and resistance numbers, what do they look like this week?
Well, yeah, and they're long-term because they're monthly support and resistance numbers. March support 361, 325, $3. Basically same as last week. Resistance 382, $4, and 418. On May, we look at 373, 359, and 349 for support, 384, $4, and 412 for resistance. On beans, now that's where the changes have come in. January, 913, 887, and 844 for support, 934, 956, and 977 for resistance. And on the March beans, we've got 929, 886, and 841 for support, and 956, 983, and 1016 for resistance. So those are significantly different from last week.
What do the export inspections look like for this week?
Well, we saw China take even more out of the Gulf and the Pacific Northwest. Wheat shipments are up 16% versus 23 last week. Corn down 58 versus 61 last week. And soybeans up 23% versus 10% last week. So we've seen some real movement on that side of the marketplace.
Open interest can be a key indicator. What's it telling us?
It certainly can. This is open interest from yesterday, of course. And on soft red wheat, we saw it go up 5,167 contracts. Hard red up a little over 1,000. Corn down 1,200. Beans down 17,365. Meal down 1,630 and soy oil down 2,739. So, you know, when you see a market like yesterday where we were bouncing higher and open interest is going down, that tells you that we're still in the midst of short covering, you know, rather than anything else going on. Not a lot of new buying coming into the market. So it's going to take a little bit for us to take the next move up.
How have you viewed what I'll call a wild ride since the trade phase one negotiations were announced last week?
Yeah, it's like, wow, you know, it is crazy. Well, I think not only the first step, of course, was the announcement of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. And then, of course, we got phase one coming in, which was a big thing. And so we saw a lot of short covering because of that. And that's why we bounced as much as we had. So, you know, this first step is about signing it. And then they'll officially release the commodities that China's pledged to buy, supposedly $80 billion worth of commodities over the next 2 years. And Informa came out with some numbers today saying they expect to see about $24 billion in beans, $2 billion in corn, $1 billion in DDGs, and $1.3 billion in cotton and $2 billion in pork each year. And then there are other commodities where they're worth less than $1 billion. So, you know, but market conditions are going to dictate these purchases. So, you know, if we would continue to rally higher and higher, you'll probably see China be very slow to move until we see something else come about. So it's a lot is hinging on what China does, and that's going to be what gives us the next step up, is if they come back into the market.
Have you been watching the biodiesel legislation in Washington, D.C.? That seems to always be approved, but it's always retroactive as well, and it played a part in the marketplace, at least for bean oil.
Well, it certainly did, and, you know, the congressional leaders yesterday unveiled a bill saying that it includes the dollar per gallon tax credit for biodiesel, and therefore, if it passes, it would be retroactive to 2018 when it lapsed, and then extended through 2022. So it needs to pass by Friday, unfortunately, in order to keep the government funded. So hopefully that's what's going to happen, but it's nice to see that it's still on the table, that they're not just forgetting about it.
Anything from the livestock sector before we turn our gaze to the south?
Yeah, we do. We have cattle on feed this week. On feed, they're expecting 101.9%, placements at 102.9%, and never good for prices. Marketing's only at 97.4%, but not unusual for this particular time of the year, especially with the weather that we've got.
What do you see from Brazil?
Well, you know, you and I have talked an awful lot about VR 163, and they've just recently paved it, and I saw pictures today, honestly, Todd, that would blow your mind. Trucks prior to the pavement, trucks that are stuck in mud that comes all the way up to the windows on the driver's sides and the passenger side. That's how deep they are in mud. And now you see today, and it's a beautiful paved road. So, you know, this is certainly going to make a difference. It's paved now all the way to the Amazon, and the amount of grain now that'll go out of Brazil's northern arc is certainly going to increase. In 19, they figured there was about 35 million tons of grain that went through there. Their capacity is 70 million tons. So, you know, this particular highway, how long do you think it took them to build it? 40 years.
You know, it seems like forever.
40 years.
How
40
many?
years.
Oh, holy smokers.
And so, yeah, it is like forever, you know. And you know, this is going to be a big driving force for them to get exports out of there. It just means that they can move things out faster, out of Mato Grosso, you know, in the places that are so far away from the other ports, and it won't be quite as expensive. Soybeans down there are 95% planted, and an interesting little fact, they only have 10 confirmed cases of rust this year, compared to 70 last year and 71 for a 5-year average. So I think that speaks volumes to the drier conditions that they actually had and have in some areas at this point in time.
Hey, remind me of one other thing about the Amazon. Let's see. So the BR-163 is going north. It hits the Amazon River. And the ports have been updated there, at least two of them, right?
It's an amazing place. If you see pictures of the Ark, and I believe that there's seven ports altogether, and two of them have expanded even further than where they were when they began. And so it's an extremely important part to them. The part that's really hard for me to understand is, you know, they're a long ways in from the ocean on the Amazon, and the water's still 200 feet deep. And so there's no problems there in terms of being able to the type of ships that they can use to, you know, haul grain out of there. It's quite the opportunity for them.
Finally, anything from Argentina?
Good old Argentina, boy, I'll tell you. Now, you remember we talked when the election was? Well, the president assumed the presidency on December 10th and announced the increase in export taxes on Saturday the 14th. And so they didn't waste any time. They want to raise those export taxes on wheat and corn from 7% to 12%, and soybeans from 30 to 33%. So they sent it to Congress. You know, it's hard to say. Basically, I think it's going to go through. There's probably no question about that. And evidently, the Argentinian farmer thinks the same because they're just reducing their purchase of inputs like fertilizer and pesticides. You know, like they're down about 55%. And excuse me, I'm wrong. They reduced their inputs of fertilizer and pesticides that they use to maximize production. But they've already got 55% of the corn crop planted and 62% of the beans planted. So they've already been committed in a lot of ways before all of this is taking place. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Hey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Todd. Have a great rest of your day.
You too. That is Jackie Vakes from Total Farm Marketing by Stuart Peterson. Let's take a look at the weather forecast now. Drew Lerner is here from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Drew, let's jump right into this. South America, Brazil, and Argentina. What are conditions like?
Well, it looks like Argentina is going to continue to deal with a problem with dryness in the southwest, but it's going to get a little bit better for a little while. We have a little disturbance that's going to move through Argentina tomorrow into Friday. Will produce showers and thunderstorms across a part of the region from Cordoba into Buenos Aires, right across a part of the most important corn and soybean production area. The rain that's going to occur probably won't fix the subsoil moisture in a significant manner, but we will see topsoil moisture improvements. Moisture totals will probably run from 4/10 inch to about 1.5 inches. That'll certainly be welcome, especially after a prolonged period of dry weather. Some of those areas have been 10 days without significant moisture. And so this will bring a little bit of relief, but it doesn't fix the entire picture here. And follow-up moisture is going to be very important. Now, there's not much rain coming up behind this event until we get out towards the middle to latter part of next week. Starting a week from today, maybe late Wednesday night, going into Thursday of next week, we'll see some showers and thunderstorms developing once again across some of that region. I don't think that that rain is initially going to be all that great, but some follow-up rain may occur in the second weekend or the last weekend of this month, and that should help to bolster soil moisture a little bit better. Some of the midday computer forecast model runs say they got a little too carried away with some of that rain in the second week, but I think the bottom line is that we will see some relief in Argentina. It's going to come in bits and pieces, and it's going to take a while for a bigger turnaround to take place. But if we can just get a little bit of moisture in here tomorrow and Friday to help revitalize the crops after a prolonged period of dryness, I think they'll probably come around. In Brazil, everything is just peachy keen there. I think most of the region from Mato Grosso into Minas Gerais and parts of Sao Paulo, as well as Paraná and Santa Catarina, all that region there, center west and center south, are getting regular currents of rain. And the temperatures are mostly seasonable in that area. It's really supporting a very good environment for aggressive crop development. Now, to the north and to the south, it's a little drier. Rio Grande do Sul, however, missed out on rain that occurred during the course of this past weekend, and so there's an area of dryness in the central portions of the state. That will fester for, maybe a week here. There's a chance for a few showers Friday and Saturday, but they won't be very significant. And then we'll have to wait until the latter part of this month to get another drink of water there. So Rio Grande, not a crisis by any means, but it has a little dry bias that's going to be around for a while. Northeast Brazil, of course, is in a droughty pattern, and that isn't going to change much at all.
What about here in the U.S. as we look towards Christmas week?
It looks to me like warmer than usual conditions and dry biased weather will occur over this next 5 to 6 days. But as we get into Christmas Day itself, we're probably going to see a first storm system coming out of the southwestern part of the country. It's going to have quite a bit of moisture laden into it. And most of Texas, as well as Oklahoma and Kansas, will see rain from this event. That rain will be quite welcome for parts of hard red winter wheat country, especially in southwestern Kansas and southeast Colorado, maybe even a part of western Oklahoma where precipitation in the autumn wasn't all that great. The storm will work its way to the upper Midwest very briefly on the 26th of December, followed by a second storm system of size that will work its way from Texas again through the heart of the Midwest, as well as the Delta in the Southeast. So enjoy the tranquil weather between now and the Christmas holiday, and then look for some more stormy weather. The good news is it'll stay warm as these storm systems come along, so we shouldn't see a lot of snow and ice, except maybe in the upper parts of the Midwest.
Hey, thanks so much, Drew. We'll talk to you next year.
All right. Have a good day.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. I'm Todd Gleason at the Illinois Farm Economics Summit in Peoria today. And tomorrow I'll be in DeKalb at Ferrandis. If you'd like to walk in for our summit event tomorrow morning, and it ends during the noon hour each day with our meal, you're welcome to do that. We open registration desk at 7:45 a.m. The same thing on Friday, except we'll be in Champaign at the I Hotel. Please join us for the Illinois Farm Economic Summits. The details are online at willag.org. All this week, as you know, I've been traveling with the agricultural economist from the University of Illinois on the Illinois Farm Economic Summits. We're in East Peoria, Illinois today at the Paradise Hotel. Tomorrow, we'll be in DeKalb at Ferrandis. Walk-ins are welcome. It's $90. Registration opens at 7:45 a.m. Same thing goes on Friday when we'll be at the iHotel in Champaign. Either place, you're welcome to come if you're not pre-registered. If you are pre-registered, I'm looking forward to seeing you. One of the people that will be on the deck at these events today, tomorrow, and on Friday is Nick Paulson. He's an ag economist that really looks into policy a great deal. Spent some time in Washington, D.C., trying to really learn how the sausage is made. I take it first that experience was revealing for you.
It was. I mean, it was a great experience. I was working within the administration, kind of charged with providing counsel, advice, analysis on mainly agricultural policy. But given what's going on in the administration and things related to agriculture, spent a considerable amount of time looking at a lot of the trade policy that this administration has moved forward on. So, you know, got to be in D.C. at a very unique, interesting time.
I want to talk about policy, and it is related to trade in particular, but farm bill sorts of policy. The things that have happened over the last couple of years, MFP in particular, what kind of background or information are you giving the producers at these IFAS meetings this week about it?
So my presentation this week kind of has, I guess, three sections to it. The first section just kind of goes over, and I think, again, one of the things that I took away from my D.C. experience was the broad range of trade policy actions that this administration has undertaken. Everything, you know, we tend to focus on in agriculture is dealing with what's going on with China and how their retaliatory tariffs have affected ag negatively. But there's other trade actions we've taken that have affected and drawn retaliation from other important trading partners. I mean, even for relatively short time periods with Canada and Mexico and some of our trading partners in the EU. So it's not just limited to China, but obviously China's the big dollar, the big ticket partner that we're focused on from an ag perspective. Secondly, again, just kind of looking at the 2018 and 2019 MFP programs, what levels of support that they ended up providing and how that has impacted incomes. Obviously, in the short term, it's provided some much-needed liquidity, some much-needed income, you know, kept incomes at a pretty decent level in 2018 between MFP and the really good yields we tended to have in 2018. And in 2019, you know, looking at least having some level of maybe low but still positive income without the MFP payments, we'd almost surely be at a negative average net farm income across the state. So from a short-term perspective, definitely positive effects. But then also looking ahead and kind of based on some of the anecdotal evidence we have of what are some of the other implications of MFP payments. And one of them that gets a lot of attention is they're basically making it maybe harder for farmers to successfully negotiate some of those cash rent levels down that again, continues to be something critical in terms of cost control given the low price environment we're in. So with MFP in particular, there's a lot of uncertainty over how long can we count on this type of support. So will there be a 2020 MFP program? You know, who knows? Indications that there could be, but now we've got a phase one trade deal. And so a lot of uncertainty about that, especially in the kind of the season where farmers are looking to negotiate cash rents for the upcoming year.
What do you think the longer term implications are as it relates to farm policy?
That's another interesting aspect I talk a little bit about in the presentation here on the program. You know, we kind of compare it to the existing mechanisms through which the federal government provides support to agriculture and mainly in the farm bill programs. Obviously, that's every 5 years we revisit those. Changes are made, and that's a public process. There's debates and committee hearings and farm groups provide input. MFP was done through a very different process. It was basically created under authority that the administration has through the Commodity Credit Corporation. They charged USDA with designing the program in terms of how to actually get the dollars out to farmers. It differed in the 2 years we've seen it. It was announced in the years it occurred in both years. And so, again, a lot of uncertainty moving ahead compared with those standing farm bill programs we have that at least for a five-year period, we kind of know how they work. We know how they're designed. You know, so I think uncertainty would be the word I keep coming back to in terms of, you know, how MFP is viewed and how it can or cannot be used in terms of any kind of, you know, even short to medium-term planning from a cash flow perspective.
Is the MFP program, as it has been used, or if it can be reconfigured in some way, a useful substitute in the future outside of the Farm Bill that Congress would take up?
So I guess I would hope that we would view MFP as a very unique, hopefully one-off, obviously two-off, approach to providing some support for damages resulting from, you know, kind of something that's obviously out of farmers' individual control, in this case, trade retaliation. You know, I think the design behind Farm Bill programs and crop insurance is much different conceptually. Those programs are standing, and they're, you know, somewhat catch-alls, but a lot of it, I think, is capturing, you know, weather effects in terms of market forces that result in low prices or low crop yields that negatively impact farmers' revenues or the prices that they receive. Again, MFP is kind of a response, an ad hoc response to, policy directions that the administration has taken that's resulted in a group, you know, suffering economic harm through no, you know, doing of their own. It's not because of a lack of productivity by U.S. farmers or anything like that. It's purely a political action that has negatively impacted them.
Well, the Trump administration has gone about on many fronts trying to reconfigure U.S. policies in different places, including the World Trade Organization or the WTO, where effectively in the last month, by not filling some of the positions there, it has limited the scope of the WTO. Are the two things together a way to reshape agricultural policy in the United States?
That's a good question. I think opinions would vary on that. Definitely, I don't feel like has been the publicly stated intent of WTO issues as well as the MFP program. MFP, the support MFP is providing, the scale of it, close to $9 billion in payments for 2018, potentially up to $14.5 billion in payments for 2019. We're getting into figures now where the WTO could take notice, just in terms of the dollars of support being provided on an annual basis to producers through that, in addition to the programs that we already have. I don't think these are necessarily part of a coordinated effort to make major changes to ag policy in the U.S. It's easy to maybe perceive it that way, but you know, I don't think there's been anything publicly stated that is a strategy.
Thanks so much, Nick.
Thank you.
Nick Paulson is an agricultural economist at the University of Illinois, traveling with us on the Illinois Farm Economic Summits.